This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The New Orleans Times-Picayune has served the Crescent City since 1837, counting among its writers William Faulkner and O. Henry. Over the past week and a half, its staff has faced a challenge of historic proportions, trying to cover the devastating effects of Hurricane Katrina, while many of its New Orleans operations were in effect washed away. The paper abandoned its New Orleans headquarters to rising floodwaters the day after the storm hit and has worked from makeshift offices and bureaus in Baton Rouge and elsewhere. The Times-Picayune made national news Sunday when it published an open letter to President Bush condemning the federal response to the storm and calling for the firing of its disaster relief officials. I spoke yesterday to Times-Picayune editor Jim Amos about the strain of trying to bring readers insight and information at a time of shared crisis. Jim Amos, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Have you published a paper continuously since the storm hit?
We have published a paper online continuously, and we had an interruption in our print publication that lasted 3 days, and then we resumed publishing at a small-town newspaper in Houma, Louisiana, beginning last Friday.
Now, for your reporters and photographers and editors, they are facing probably the biggest story most of them will ever see, the kind of thing that requires enormous effort and overtime. But this is at a time when their homes and families are facing enormous stress and peril. As a boss, how do you deal with those pressures?
You know, it's you express gratitude right and left whenever you possibly can, because it's just an enormous sacrifice, and it's an astounding team spirit that's just manifested every day and without interruption, without pause on weekends, and in the face, as you say, of the knowledge that everything, in some cases everything they have, has been lost.
Have any of your folks had to say, look, I got to have a few days, I just got to get out of here?
Usually the dynamic has been that we have had to force people to take a day off, lest they become totally exhausted. And of their own volition, most people just want to soldier on, and you can't allow that to happen if you want to be responsible about it and want to have sane, healthy people.
Have you had a day off?
I don't know if I'd call it a day off. Yesterday I trekked into New Orleans and actually managed to get past all the soldiery surrounding our city and visited some of our team of reporters and photographers were there, and then with my son managed to ford the waters that surrounded our house and to get into it and close it up because it had been looted. And then got back here for a few meetings. So that was the only pause so far.
That's anything but a vacation.
Tell
me what you found at your own house.
I found water, first of all. It was an obstacle course getting there down what was once a beautiful boulevard in New Orleans, Esplanade Avenue, and is now a Venice-like canal littered with power lines and oak tree branches. And took a newspaper delivery truck that could get through 2 to 3 feet of water. And I found my house, this is the highest lying ground other than the French Quarter in all of New Orleans, and yet this street was under at least 2 to 3 feet of water. I'm very lucky. I mean, first of all, I'm very lucky in that all my family members escaped safely, including my parents and my brothers. We're all New Orleanians, and they all got out and are safe and sound. And secondly, I'm blessed in that water did not actually enter my house. So to have had somebody break in through a window and ransack the place and take a few silly electronic items that can easily be replaced is in the scheme of things, a very minor event.
Tell me some of the conditions that your reporters and photographers have faced in getting stories.
Well, the most arduous task has been reporting in New Orleans itself, because especially in the initial days after the storm, when we evacuated our building, we as soon as we'd gotten to dry land across the river from our plant, we realized that we couldn't just trek on. We had to send a team back into the city to report, so that we would have a presence there and at least a paper for the next day. And we got a volunteer group of about 9 people to do that, reporters and photographers who established themselves in a columnist's house and eventually got a generator and lived this hand-to-mouth existence while reporting all along. So that has been the most difficult obstacle to report under those circumstances, to encounter criminals on the street who had free rein and who threatened our people, to really have to defend ourselves even as we were going about journalism.
What did you do to ensure the safety of your folks?
You know, there's not much you can do except rely on their good judgment not to put themselves in terrible situations. And fortunately, we had people who were quite mature and didn't do stupid things. The most adventurous thing that one of them did was our sports editor, David Meeks, who is a terrific journalist and a great leader, at one point decided he just had to get back to his house, which was in the Lakeview part of town, and that is an utterly inundated place where houses are up to their roofs in water. And he swam into his house and rescued his dog from a room in the rear, and put himself in considerable danger in the process, but I guess that's an understandable impulse.
He and the dog are now safe?
He and the dog are now safe.
What kind of encounters did your staff have with criminals?
You know, observing people, breaking into cars, encountering marauding gangs who asked for money and, you know, couldn't always be obliged. And also, you know, it's difficult in an atmosphere in which, in the eyes of the National Guard and the soldiers and the New Orleans police, for that matter, everybody who's wandering the streets is a suspect unless they're law enforcement. It's difficult under those circumstances to always instantly establish that, hey, we're journalists, leave us alone, please, and let us go about our business. So we're stopped, and in some cases, in one case, a gun was held to a reporter's head. In another case, some soldiers made someone walk ahead with a gun pointed at his back. Those kinds of situations arose frequently.
How do they get around? Bikes, boats, SUVs?
All of the above. There are some parts of the city that are obviously only accessible by boat. We have a kayak in the rear of the newspaper delivery truck that we use to get around in some parts of the city. Bicycles have come in very handy. Bicycles were the first were our means of discovering the breach in the levee on the very first day of the hurricane and enabled us to put that story online. We had two reporters who ventured into their neighborhood in this Lakeview neighborhood, discovered the breach in the levee and the water gushing in, and rode their bikes back to the newspaper plant and got the story online Monday evening when Katrina's winds were still blowing. While much of the national reporting was essentially saying New Orleans had dodged the bullet again, and in fact the real catastrophe was just beginning.
A newspaper is a business, and you were flooded out of your New Orleans headquarters, and most of your subscribers, of course, have, I suppose, disappeared for the moment. How do you reach your readers, your advertisers? Can you make this a going concern?
Well, we're already making it a going concern, of course, not on the scale of what it was 10 days ago, but business is slowly returning. We now are publishing a 16-page newspaper because that's the capacity of this press, of the Homer Courier, which is allowing us to publish. And we're already at capacity on ads. We're about 50% ads at this point. And our readers are returning to their homes, not in the city of New Orleans, but in the surrounding suburbs. There's a recovery that's proceeding more speedily than any of us could have dared to hope a week ago. So we're distributing there. Readers are coming to our suburban bureaus and clamoring for the paper. And, of course, the online edition is a lifeline for this diaspora of New Orleanians that are scattered around the South. And it keeps us in the minds and hearts of our readers, and hopefully they will be wanting us when they return as a print edition.
Yeah, I imagine your website has gotten a lot of hits from folks who want to clutch the city that they lost.
Our website is getting more than 30 million hits a day, yeah.
As we understand it, FEMA is instructing journalists not to photograph bodies. I mean, you have a really talented photo staff at that newspaper. How are you responding to that?
Government is full of instructions about how journalists should behave, and I think our job is to cover the news, and the death in the city is part of the news.
You'll handle it with taste, of course, but you're going to shoot what you need to shoot.
Exactly.
We're speaking with James Amos. He is the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Amos. He is the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Your newspaper published an open letter to the president calling for a house cleaning of FEMA and the firing of its director, Michael Brown. At what point in this saga was it clear to you that the government, that the federal response here was absolutely inexcusable?
I would say it became clear about 2 days after the storm, when people were trapped in the Superdome with no way to get out, when people were beginning to become dehydrated and in some cases die in the convention center of New Orleans. As late as Tuesday, FEMA professed unawareness of these things. We had a story in this morning's paper in which a FEMA official said they only became aware on Tuesday afternoon that there might be a breach in the levee that was sending water into the city. And in the editorial, we mentioned that that Mr. Brown professed at the end of the week that meals were being fed at least once, if not twice a day, to people in the convention center. We knew from our own reporting that to be utterly untrue. So all that bespoke to us a singular lack of awareness of the reality that was unfolding in the greatest natural disaster to ever beset an American city. I think it's not an exaggeration to describe it that way.
3 years ago, your own newspaper published a series which warned of this very kind of catastrophe. I mean, given that the possibility of this kind of disaster was known, how much responsibility do you place with state and local officials for not being ready and not responding effectively?
Well, there was a certain degree of readiness and discussion on everyone's part, and it would not be fair to say that the worst wasn't anticipated given the direction of the storm and given the strength of the storm's winds. Nonetheless, our series, when it was published, did not engender the sort of drastic action that might have mitigated this disaster. And I guess that's partly because, ordinary people, readers, don't want to hear that kind of bad news. You know, we described in detail what would happen in this kind of a storm, how the water would top the levees or break through the levees, how the city would be inundated, and how all power would fail, and as a result, the pumps that normally empty the city of rainwater would be idle, and the city, which is bowl-shaped, would fill with water, and it would remain there. Nobody wants to hear that, and I imagine that most people consoled themselves with the notion that this was a far-fetched scenario. It might happen in 100 years. It might never happen, but surely it wouldn't happen tomorrow or next week. And it's a kind of drastic message that that this requires a nimble bureaucracy, and I've yet to encounter a nimble bureaucracy. And it's also not easily translatable into political will and the sort of political effort that would drum up sufficient funds to shore up the coastline, restore the wetlands, make the barrier islands protective. All those things cost a ton of money, and a newspaper series, however graphic, just wasn't sufficient to get people's full attention.
When it was clear New Orleans was in for a terrible storm, Mayor Ray Nagin did order a mandatory evacuation. Of course, there was no provision for offering transportation to the city's poor. Should that have happened, and should it have been the city's responsibility?
Well, of course it should have happened, and it would have been great had it happened, but it flies in the face of reality. First of all, to get the buses, you have to also commandeer drivers, and I would imagine that many of these drivers are resourceful enough to have evacuated themselves. It supposes that that the kind of people who needed to be evacuated are really are willing to do so and abandon their town. These are people who are very poor and who have probably never left New Orleans in many cases, and for whom the idea of walking away from their abode is just inconceivable. And finally, it is far from clear that the mayor had the legal authority to mandate that there be an evacuation. That's a question that has not been settled. It should have been settled a long time ago, but it has not. And so, even though it was a drastic step for him to have called for one, and he should have called for one, it didn't have a lot of teeth in it as an order.
We spoke earlier about FEMA's inability to respond to the break in the levees and to bring immediate aid to those in such distress in New Orleans. Since the president has gotten more visibly involved, what do you think of FEMA's response in more recent days?
I think if you go through New Orleans, as I did yesterday, there's much more visual evidence of an overall federal government response that's quite substantial and that's making a difference, albeit belatedly. In the long term, there's going to have to be more than just enforcing the law and getting rid of the bandits. So I think, the next year will be the proving ground of whether the federal effort is really what the president said he intended it to be.
There is, of course, a lot of public determination to rebuild. Are there one or two particular issues you think everyone needs to bear in mind as they plan reconstruction?
Well, I think from a public policy point of view that the rebuilding has to be accompanied by some major national effort that helps make the coastline less vulnerable, and that will give people the kind of confidence they need to return in large numbers. And I think on the part of the people who do return, there has to be a degree of energy and patience, because it's going to take a while, and also a resignation to the fact that much of the city, not much of the city, well, large parts of the city simply will not be able to be renovated. If you have a wooden housing stock, as ours largely is, marinating in this toxic stew for weeks on end, much of that can't be salvaged.
Hundreds of thousands of people from New Orleans and the surrounding area have been evacuated and are in some places in Texas, like the Astrodome. They're in Red Cross and Salvation Army and FEMA emergency facilities all over the place. I'm wondering how your staff approaches that story. What are the big issues and challenges you see in that side of this disaster?
Well, journalistically, one of the big challenges is just finding these people because they're so dispersed across the nation, really. And it makes it really a story that's tailor-made for a website and for the internet. And we've been tremendously lucky in getting lots of responses from readers in far-flung places. We also have the advantage of having our own evacuees of our staff who in some cases went pretty far, and we're using their remoteness to tap into the readers that they're finding in places like Chicago and Houston, wherever else people may have gone.
You're not just covering the difficulties and tragedies in the city. You have a lively sports section. How are you keeping that going?
There are lots of sports stories to report now, and most of them are quite newsy, having to do with the future of the teams and where games will be played and whether there will be teams. And, of course, in the case of college sports, what's going to happen if, as seems the case, there will be at least a semester's interruption in the existence of schools. So that's given us considerable fodder.
And people always need their sports, don't they?
People always need their sports.
Besides being the editor of this newspaper, which plays, of course, an important civic role in a critical time, you are from New Orleans. Your family lives there. You've lost so much. You and your family have lost so much, and your city has lost so much. Do you ever stop and reflect on that, or do you need to set it aside to continue to do your job?
To be honest, I wake up at about 3 or 4 in the morning, and I think about it for several hours, unable to sleep, wondering what will become of us all and whether we'll be able to, how we will be able to recreate what we had. It's just New Orleans is such an extraordinary culture, and it is not it's not transportable. It's really a unique way of life for the people who live there, and that ultimately, I think, is why it will draw people back irresistibly.
Well, I wish you the best of luck putting your newspaper and your city back together. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Jim Amos is editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.